Before I get started, I'd like to tell all of you to check out CrimeCon, which is a true crime convention taking place in Indianapolis in June. I'm hoping to be there, along with Tyson and an army of other true crime hosts and experts, so I'm hoping it'll be a unique experience unlike any other. You can use the code UNRESOLVED to save 20% of your registration costs, and I sincerely hope to see all of you there. Also, listen through to the close to learn more about supporting the UNRESOLVED podcast on Patreon, and find out about some important changes coming up for the podcast in the near future. I won't bore you with all that right now, but it may impact how you access and listen to the podcast in the future, so stay tuned.
Sent Thursday, March 27th at 3:50 p.m.
Hey, man. What's up? Where'd you go, dude? I just got back from having to run downtown. The roofing guy said you left like 2 hours ago or something, I think. They just left out of here, but call me, man. Well, you don't go home.
End of message.
Chase Massener is a husband and father with two young daughters, and police originally thought Chase disappeared from a QT store where he worked in Kennesaw, but now they say he vanished from a friend's home.
This isn't him. He would never do this, and you know, he wouldn't just go and leave his family and his loved ones here.
Bottom line is that we have a missing veteran. We have a friend, a son, a father, and our main goal has always been to bring him home, and that emotion will never end until he's brought back home.
Time has not healed the pain of the family and friends of Chase Massener, a young Iraqi war veteran who disappeared without a trace 15 months ago. And despite some intense searching, few clues have been found.
Hello, welcome to the Unresolved Podcast. My name is Michael Whelan, and this episode is going to discuss the disappearance of Georgian native Chase Massener. As you heard in the intro, this is a story that has been covered by some local Georgian news outlets, and even true crime host Nancy Grace herself, but it remains pretty under-discussed at large. This episode is going to try and detail the life of Chase Massener up until his disappearance, including the cast of characters that surrounded him in his final known days. And later in the episode, I'll also feature a discussion I had not too long ago with Nancy Grace herself, so stay tuned for that. This is the story of Chase Massener. Chase Tyler Massener was born on September 4th, 1987, to his father Corbin Massener and his mother Stephanie Cadena. Both parents were very young, just a hair above 20 years old, so it's not a huge shock to me that the two did not grow old together. Records for Chase's early life are few and far in between, the only thing being an arrest for marijuana possession on August 22nd, 2005. Chase was just 18 years old, and the mugshot of him is a far cry from the man he would later become. I assume that the charge did not stick, or else Chase probably would not have been able to accomplish one of his life's goals, enlisting in the United States Army. In the latter half of the 2000s, Chase would join the U.S. military, and he would later get sent halfway across the world to serve a year in Iraq. When Chase returned, he was suffering from the effects of post-traumatic stress disorder. At least, that's what his wife Amanda would later say. Amanda and Chase would date and get married during this time period, the time around Chase's return from Iraq. He would be discharged from the army, presumably due to cutbacks. Kristen Amanda Chatham, who was called Amanda by everyone in her life, would become Amanda Masner. The couple's first child, a beautiful daughter named Sydney, would be born shortly thereafter. I wish I could say that things would come together for this young couple who presumably didn't want to repeat the mistakes of Chase's parents. Unfortunately, their situation would become complicated over the next few years, creating a situation that would make any future investigation a bit of a nightmare. It seems that throughout his life, Chase remained close with his family. His mother, Stephanie Cadena, has worked with a family-owned auto repair company for years now, and always had a close relationship with her son. Apparently, whenever Chase had trouble with Amanda, he would go to his mother's to stay the night or to simply talk and discuss his issues. The two seemed to have the type of relationship that any mother and son should have. However, Chase's relationship with his dad is a definite mystery to me. Corbin Masner, Chase's father, is an entity that I consider a bit of a wild card to the investigation. He was apparently a truck driver who in the months before Chase's disappearance had moved in with Chase's family. He had apparently been let go from his job for a reason I'll discuss later. This would only compound a financial situation that was getting tricky for Chase and his wife, Amanda, to manage. You see, after Chase had been discharged from the military, he would struggle to make ends meet. He would work random jobs, but struggled to stay employed to the point of providing for his family. Then, when Amanda became pregnant with their second child, that struggle seemed to worsen. He took a job as the night manager of a nearby Quick Trip, located off of Bells Ferry Road in Kennesaw, Georgia. This meant that he would have to work the overnight shift, but he would be able to at least keep a roof over his family's head for the time being. This Quick Trip was about 13 miles away from the Masner family home, located on Saranoia Drive in Canton, Georgia. However, the Quick Trip was just over a mile away from the home of Chase's friend, Brad Clement, who will come into play momentarily. When one looks at pictures of Chase's home, located up in Canton, Georgia, they wonder how a family of four, five if you include Chase's father Corbin, was able to live in it off of just a single hourly wage. Word has been that the couple got a good deal on it, but as someone who's worked hourly jobs for the better part of the last decade, I truly wonder how far that extends. Because of this financial instability, things had been growing rather tense between Chase and Amanda. Now with two kids on their hands, and Chase's schedule completely flipped on its head, things seemed poised to snap for this young couple struggling to make ends meet. In March of 2014, the struggles between Chase and Amanda continued. Their arguments were becoming more and more frequent, and apparently Chase would use his mother, Stephanie Cadena, as an outlet of sorts to help mediate the issues. At times, this would just be Stephanie being called to help out with an issue or two. However, at other times, it would mean that Chase stayed over at her house for a night or two, to simply let the couple have some space and work out their differences on a later date. Amanda called Stephanie, and apparently told her about the issues the couple had been having lately. Most of it stemmed from their financial woes, but there was a lot of frustration and tension there. According to both Stephanie and Amanda, it wasn't anything insurmountable, but it was leading the couple to a place where they didn't want to be. So it was decided Chase would spend a few nights at his mom's home, to let cooler heads prevail later on. On Wednesday, March 26th, Amanda picked up Chase from his mother, Stephanie's home. Their two kids were in the back seat, waiting to see their dad once again. They all said their goodbyes to Grandma, Stephanie having no idea at the time that it would be the last time she'd ever see her son. This is where the story begins to enter the murky territory of he said, she said. From this point forward, all we have to go on is the testimony of the band of characters around Chase Masner. Namely, his wife Amanda, and the friend I mentioned just a moment ago, Brad Clement. On the way home from Chase's mother's house, apparently, the arguments struck up once again. It was apparently so bad that the couple didn't even make it home together. Some have rumored that Amanda kicked Chase out of the car, but all we know is that Chase would be dropped off just a few miles away, at the Quick Trip location he worked at off of Bells Ferry Road. Seeing as the couple lived over 10 miles away, north in Canton, it goes to reason that the couple had been in the car for only a few minutes before the argument got so bad that they couldn't even make it home together. James Bradshaw Clement, most commonly referred to by his middle name Brad, was a friend of Chase's. I cannot tell you how the two became friends, whether they knew each other before Chase's deployment to Iraq or not. But they were roughly the same age, and both grew up around the Atlanta area. They had apparently only hung out together a few times, so I'm really curious as to how they became acquainted. Brad lived in Kennesaw, Georgia, which is a small town about half an hour to the north of Atlanta, on a good day of traffic. I lived not too far from this area, so I could tell you that the Atlanta area itself is very, very busy, but the surrounding areas are surprisingly beautiful. You can travel just a few miles outside of Atlanta and hit some pretty scenic patches of forest. Kennesaw is no exception, with a beautiful downtown and a population hovering at around 30,000. Brad worked with computers for a living, which he would fix up in his home. Records show that he was also working for T-Mobile at around this time period, but without speaking to him, I can't really verify that. Nonetheless, Brad seemed to be a pretty self-made man. He owned his own home, a rather nice one, at the end of a cul-de-sac on Farmbrook Trail. He seemed like a pretty regular guy. He still does, despite the maelstrom that has become his life in the years since. After Amanda dropped Chase off at the Quick Trip that he worked at, which was just over a mile away from Brad's home, he apparently went to pick up his buddy. For the rest of the evening, these two friends apparently spent a good chunk of their time talking. Brad remembers that Chase told him all about the issues him and Amanda were having, and that the two just hung around to shoot the breeze for a while. And, according to Brad, he had also tried to play mediator for a bit. For a while after Chase's future disappearance, text messages between him and Amanda on the night in question would become analyzed by investigators, but apparently most of them were sent by Brad himself. He was apparently texting Amanda through Chase's phone, trying to help the two of them bridge the gap. In these text messages to Amanda, he apparently had begun floating the idea of a barbecue. You see, Brad was having roofers working on his house throughout this time period in March of 2014, and he was planning to host a barbecue for them the next night. He wanted Chase to invite Amanda and their kids, and hopefully help calm things down with some burgers and hot dogs, or whatever it was they were cooking. Maybe I'm just hungry and daydreaming. The next morning, on Thursday, the 27th of March, Brad woke up with the intention of delivering a computer to a client's home. He had been working on it for a bit, and had been finishing it up the previous night as he spoke to Chase. He told Chase to hang out at his house throughout the day, just to sleep in and catch a bit of a break. This is where one of the most peculiar aspects of the story come into play. When Brad left to deliver this computer, he also took Chase's cell phone with him. Chase's cell phone case was also his wallet, so this meant that Brad was taking away Chase's lifeline, essentially. However, he states that he was doing this in an effort to keep Chase at his home. After all, without his cell phone or his wallet, how could Chase get anywhere? Needless to say, the story continues to get muddled after this. One of the biggest hurdles facing this story is whether or not Brad Clement was telling the truth. Because, as sad as it is to say, all we know about Chase's final hours are based off of his testimony. Brad recalls the day that Chase vanished as a rather mundane one. He had taken Chase's cell phone with him to prevent Chase from leaving his home, and he ran some errands with it in his possession. He delivered his client's computer, came back home, and apparently Chase was still there at this time. But then he states that he left again that afternoon to pick up groceries for the barbecue, and around this time was when Chase apparently disappeared. In a recent interview on Nancy Grace's podcast, Brad tells of how him and Chase smoked some weed and drank some alcohol on the night in question, but he doesn't go into much detail. He also states that when he picked up Chase, he found the Army veteran looking for, quote-unquote, Roxy pills, also known as Roxycodone, an opiate pain reliever that has become popular over the last few years. You'd think that this would be a huge clue for the investigation. If someone is ever trying to score drugs, all they really ever need is a contact to get the drugs and the money to purchase them. Brad pleads ignorance when it comes to that kind of substance, stating that he had taken them in the past after a car accident and really disliked them, but did not know where to get any. However, he also claims to have given Chase $60 before his disappearance, which leads me to think that Chase might have been looking for a substance for any reason at all, whether it be his relationship issues, his PTSD, or whatever it may have been. This is something that a lot of media outlets seem to have overlooked. Brad, while perhaps being the wild card of the entire story, is the only person we have that can vouch for the final 24 hours of Chase's life. And sadly, most of what he says is brushed off to the side as people rush to suspicions about him personally. As I said just a few minutes ago, during this time period, Brad was having work done to his home, primarily having his roof replaced by a small operation known as Duck's Roofing. Brandon Duck, the owner and operator of Duck's Roofing, was at Brad's house for a large chunk of that day, along with a couple of his employees. When Brad returned from running errands, the roofers remembered seeing him and interacting with him. They had also seen him that morning when they first showed up. They were even planning on staying, as Brad had invited them for a cookout. Brad returned from the grocery store and began preparing for the barbecue. He claims that in the process of getting the grill going, that he accidentally caught a section of his backyard on fire. He apparently had to go through quite an ordeal putting it out, and when he came back inside to talk to Chase about it, his friend was allegedly gone. This is approximately when the following phone call takes place.
Sent Thursday, March 27th at 3:50 p.m.
Hey man, what's up? Where'd you go, dude? I just got back from having to run downtown. The roofing guy said you left like 2 hours ago or something, I think. They just left out of here, but call me, man. Well, you know,
end of message.
This voicemail establishes just a couple of things. First off, this means that Chase had disappeared or gone missing in the middle of the day. You'd think that someone would have seen him leaving, since Brad's house was at the end of a cul-de-sac and it would have taken Chase a good walk to get out of the neighborhood, roughly half a mile. However, another thing it establishes is that Brad's testimony was getting shaky. You see, those roofers that were working on his home, Brandon Duck, who had at least two co-workers with him, none of them remember seeing Chase whatsoever. Not in the morning, not in the afternoon, and definitely not leaving Brad Clement's home. I don't want to throw any stones at Brad Clement. For all I know, he's as innocent as anyone in the story, but things like that don't do him any favors. He would later state that hearing that Chase had left from his roofers was just a simple miscommunication, but one has to wonder how such a thing happens. How would someone tell you a house guest had left when they had no idea they were there in the first place? It just boggles the mind. Needless to say, though, the search was beginning for Chase Masner. Apparently, before Brad made his call to Chase's phone, word had already begun to spread to Chase's family. I could not begin to tell you how the game of telephone worked, but at this point, Brad was under the assumption that Amanda had picked up Chase from his home while he was in the backyard. However, it was clear that Chase's family had begun discussing Chase's extended absence just a tad beforehand.
March 27th at 3:37 p.m.
Hi, baby. Will you please give me a call? I'm assuming that you're just sleeping, which is totally okay, but I need to know that you're all right. I love you.
End of message.
That was a recorded voicemail from Stephanie Cadena, Chase's mother, placed roughly 15 minutes before Brad called Chase. In it, she's already worrying about Chase's whereabouts after learning that he had never made it home with Amanda the prior evening. They began to work their way through the motions, finding out where Chase had last been and working their way from there. Amanda and Stephanie got in touch with Brad, who informed them that Chase had slipped out that afternoon, apparently being spotted by the roofers working on his home, which we now know did not happen. However, they began to get in touch with Chase's other friends and associates, but had no such luck in finding him. No one in Brad's neighborhood recalls seeing Chase that afternoon. I mean, you can't really blame them on that. Would you be aware of someone walking around your neighborhood in the approximate time frame of 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock in the afternoon? I definitely wouldn't. But the odds of no one spotting him has to be pretty low, I'd wager. His story was soon called into the police by his mother, Stephanie, but unfortunately they began investigating him as a voluntary departure, meaning, of course, that they believed he disappeared willingly. One of the many aspects of the case that has continued to haunt it, now going on 3 years, is the fact that it was first investigated by Chase's hometown Cherokee County Police Force. As I stated before, he lived in Canton, Georgia with his wife Amanda, his two children, and now his father Corbin. Therefore, it fell upon Cherokee County Police to investigate his absence. But when things like this happen, other things begin to fall in between the gaps. I covered this type of occurrence back in the Long Island serial killer episodes, when some of the girls, namely Shannon Gilbert, disappeared in one area but had their cases handled by their hometown police force, who often lived miles away. Chase was last seen in Kennesaw, Georgia, which is located in Cobb County. Because of the overlap, this saw the case hit some hurdles from the very get-go. The most insurmountable disadvantage Chase's family saw was when police investigated Chase's disappearance as a voluntary absence. This meant, basically, that they thought he had run away. On the episodes of Nancy Grace's podcast featuring an interview with Brad Clement, he states that Chase had stated, on more than one occasion, that he was going to, quote-unquote, run away and live in the woods. Obviously, I can't say whether this was a common expression of his or not. I can't find anyone else that vouches for these statements, but police must have found some hint of truth in them, because they didn't think that there was anything nefarious about Chase's disappearance. At least at first. But as the hours turned into days, the belief that he had simply gone willing into the night began to be stretched thin. He supposedly had his debit card and cell phone with him, but the last that his debit card was used was the night before his disappearance, Wednesday, March 26th. This debit card usage was just for a couple of dollars, I believe, meaning that it could have been for anything. Soda, a beer, a snack, chapstick, you name it. The last time that Chase's phone would be used was the next day, March 27th. This was the day he disappeared. He had made a call the night before on Wednesday, at roughly 10:30 in the evening, but I honestly couldn't tell you to who that call was made. You see, the unfortunate thing is that, just like Chase, we have no idea what happened to his cell phone. Some statements would have you believe that Brad was holding onto it all day long, but there's just no evidence to support that. And some statements have perhaps been taken out of context to imply that Amanda has had it, but we do know that Chase had upgraded his phone a month or so before his absence, meaning that Amanda may have simply had Chase's old phone, which would likely still have had old text messages, photos, contacts, etc. However, none of this would help police. Even when they began to investigate Chase's case more urgently, and it was finally handed back to the Cobb County Police Squad, whose jurisdiction was the area where Chase actually disappeared, all trace of him was gone in the wind. Brad Clement has not been alone in facing backlash regarding statements made after Chase's disappearance. Amanda Masner, Chase's own wife, has also become one of the internet's prime suspects because of conflicting statements she made about the last night she was with Chase, Wednesday, March 26th. In the days after her husband's disappearance, Amanda supposedly gave conflicting statements about where exactly she had dropped him off. Stephanie Cadena, Chase's mother, recalls hearing from Amanda that she had dropped him off at the Quick Trip that he worked at. However, she also recalls hearing in another instance how Amanda had dropped him off directly at Brad's home. Here's a phone call Amanda was making to someone, in which she mentions how scrutinized she would become in the weeks and months after Chase's disappearance.
People are just starting to come at me, and I'll tell anybody. You know, put me on a lie detector. Search my house, search my phone, do whatever you want if it helps.
Amanda would also face scrutiny from Brad Clement himself, of all people. In his recent interview with Nancy Grace, Brad alleges that Amanda came to him the day after Chase's disappearance, not only looking for weed, but also somewhat hating on him. He says without explicitly saying that she was flirting with him, as if she was mad at Chase for running away and wanted to get back at him in some way. Brad also alleges that Amanda's mother was growing weed and that Amanda was somehow involved in that operation, but he doesn't give any real details. Here's another clip from Amanda, when she was questioned by a veterans group who was launching a search for Chase.
Drugs have not ever been my thing. Chase has struggled with them. And it has been something that we struggled with for a long time. But that's not my thing. And people are just making me out to be this big drug person. And it's just, that's one of the reasons I shut down from everybody. Is because everybody started making false accusations and threatening with defects and all of this stuff And I was like, okay, well, apparently people are manipulating and twisting me and twisting my words and twisting Chase's problems to make them my problems, because I was told that you said that the drugs were all me and that Chase is a golden boy and that I'm the one that had problems with them. And that is, that's just so far from the truth, the furthest thing from the truth. And
I, okay, let me, I'm so glad that you're laying these out on the table, that you're being straight with me on this. This is what I need you to do, because I need to hear what's coming from you and you need to hear what's coming from me. This is what I was told. Chase's drug of choice is heroin. He did heroin as a teenager.
Chase's drug of choice was not heroin. It was pot. But he struggled with it when he was younger. And he's struggled with it one time since we've gotten married, on one occasion.
There are a few things to unpack from that. First of all, it's hard to differentiate whether or not she's talking about Chase having an issue with marijuana or heroin at the end there. Before I listened to this audio, I was honestly unaware that Chase had struggled with any hard narcotics in the past. When you read about him, it's generally very positive stuff. When it comes to missing persons reports, you don't often hear about the negatives of their life. Which really sucks, in my opinion, because it's often those negatives that can help create leads to find out what happened to them. Case in point, if Chase had had issues in the past with heroin and was out looking for an opiate, it makes sense to think that he might have gotten a hold of some. But I'll get into that bee's nest later. However, another piece from that audio is at the very beginning, when Amanda mentions that she had closed off from everyone. In the weeks after Chase's disappearance, Amanda was very much in front of the case, pleading with everything and everyone to help bring about some results. However, over time, she has become more withdrawn, eventually leaving Georgia and refusing to speak to anyone about the case. This is mainly because of a man named Paul Libri. Paul Libri was a private investigator operating out of Georgia, who became embedded in the search to find Chase Masner in 2014. He endeared himself to Amanda Masner, and I'm assuming was eventually hired by the mother of two to help find her missing husband. Here's a conversation between the two, in which Amanda tells Libri her thoughts about the case, about Brad Clement himself, and what she wants done to find her husband.
And that's why the only thing I keep saying is, okay, get in front of a lie detector, take a lie detector, prove it to me.
And I think that's the point we're at, because everybody's lying. Everybody's got four stories. At least three.
I can't keep up with it, and I can't believe anybody. And it's like, when he was at my house, why would he bring up the fact that, like, he just was bringing up things, like, I'm trying to quote him exactly, but he was just, like, going on, and he was like, and if somebody OD'd at my house, I know how to handle it. I wouldn't freak out and let him die. I'd have to give him CPR. I know this.
Well, and he has said that exact same quote to me.
And I'm just like, why would you
even bring that up?
Asking you that. Yeah, like, why would you bring that up? Why would you even want to put that in my head? Like, don't do that to his wife. You know, like, why would you go there? I didn't even see that. I just feel like there's so many people that are hiding little details.
Well, there is, and all the little details wind up being big issues. Because the little details are hurting us as far as eliminating people. I mean, I can't eliminate Brad. I can't. The reason I can is because of that roofer problem right there. I can't eliminate him because of that. As much as I want to believe Brad, and I really do, that whole thing about the roofer saying they seen him leave keeps him in the loop.
He's obviously hiding something about what happened when he left. I want everybody to get in the same room. Like, I want to invite every single person in this case over to my house and then let them all talk so that we have a timeline.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I do it at your house, but I see what you're saying.
I mean, somewhere. We could do it at Quick Trip. We could do it at the Arby's. We could do it anywhere. But I want everybody in the same room, and I want everybody to explain to me exactly what happened and when. Because at least then I'll put a timeline, a definite.
Well, and I think that'd be a big thing for us, too, is that we can get, you know, damn, everything in the open, kind of.
Right. And,
you know, I want somebody to say to somebody to say to somebody else, you're lying.
Right. Somebody might step over somebody else's story. But could we do that? Could we try to organize something where everybody...
I don't see why not. I mean, I think that's the best idea that anybody's come up with since we started this case.
Because I want to hear Brad...
I want to see who don't show up.
And Shauna.
I want to see who don't show up. That's the other thing.
But I want to personally invite them. I want to ask them. And I just want to... I want everyone to have their... On their schedule, this is when we're meeting. And I don't want... I don't want it to be a lot of people from your team. Because I don't want people to get freaked out. Like, honestly, it would probably be better if it was just, like, you or you and one other person, but then just everyone that has a piece of the story so they feel comfortable. They don't feel like they're being interrogated. And then just let them talk as long as they want. And just let them talk to each other and hear what they have to say. Hear where they have a problem. Because I just... Something doesn't make sense. I don't know. I'm starting to, like, question every single person I know. If I trust him, do I really know this person? I mean, I'm going crazy with, like, paranoia and conspiracy. What if this happens? And I just...
Unfortunately, unknown to Amanda, Paul Libri was facing charges of impersonating a police officer in another investigation. This would eventually land him in prison with a 5-year conviction. He had apparently pretended to be a cop during the investigation of a missing teenage girl in Palmetto, Georgia. In 2015, he was found guilty of 2 charges of impersonating a police officer and 1 charge each of both identity fraud and obstruction of justice. Charges spanning across multiple occasions where he had pretended to be a police officer. It was after this, after putting so much faith and information in the hands of a private investigator, that Amanda began to shut herself off from the outside world. She hasn't spoken to the media in quite some time. Not about Chase, his disappearance, or anything involving the two. She left Georgia with her daughters and moved to Iowa under understandable circumstances. If I may, I'll turn the focus back on Brad Clement for a bit. In the weeks after Chase Masner's disappearance, Brad was not suspected of any wrongdoing. Police did not believe that he had anything to do with Chase being missing. After all, they were originally investigating him as a voluntary departure. Brad was originally asked to take a polygraph by the police, but refused. He stated that his nerves would have been too messed up to take one. And honestly, I can't blame him. After doing a good amount of research on polygraphs, I don't believe that they are really good indicators of truth whatsoever. Anyone with a brain can try and figure out how to fake one, which I talked about a bit in the Misty Copsy episodes of the podcast. Also, they don't really measure truth, just someone's stress level regarding a question, the verbiage of which can be what triggers a response, not the question itself. For example, if I were to ask you, did you kill this person? You might have a strong response no matter whether you did or not. I just can't blame Brad for not wanting to subject himself to that, and to maybe even implicate himself based on a heartbeat. However, word began to reach police that Brad, who had been having work done on his home, had a large dumpster in front of his house. Several people, many of Chase's friends and family, wanted police to investigate this. Police would eventually get around to it, sometime after Chase had already gone missing. However, they would later discover that the dumpster they had examined at a local landfill had been the wrong one. By the time they recognized their mistake, it was too costly to fix. The dumpster had already been dumped into a local landfill, and they have openly admitted to Chase's family that the cost of going back to search the area where the dumpster was disposed of would be upwards of 7 digits. Sadly, even if this was more than just a hunch, it would be a very costly endeavor. And the chances of them finding something, after more than 3 years, would be slim to none to begin with. Brad Clement was never an official suspect by police, even though the story of this mysterious dumpster and his ever-changing alibi have made him a prime suspect in the public eye. He has faced some pretty severe public backlash in the years since, which even drove him out of his home and out of the area he grew up in. He moved out of his home just months after Chase disappeared, and his only public sighting was during his interview with Nancy Grace just a month or so ago. I'll get into some theories of mine in just a moment. But I had the opportunity to speak to famous personality Nancy Grace not too long ago. I know that she's a very divisive figure when it comes to true crime, but I was pleasantly surprised that she took the time to speak to me about Chase Masner, which is a story that she's really done a lot to promote. But here you go, my conversation with Nancy Grace.
Hi, how are you doing today?
I'm great, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm really happy to speak to you. Thank you for speaking to me today. I really do appreciate it.
You're kidding, I'm looking forward to it.
All right, well, thank you. First off, I guess I'll just jump right into it.
Awesome. Okay, hold on. I just got my twins to school and I'm settling in. Okay.
Gotcha.
Okay, go ahead, dear.
Okay. Well, I guess first off, I just want to, I know you're here to, speak to me today about the case of Chase Masner.
I'm happy to, and, I'm very concerned about not only this, but the whole investigation went down, not necessarily that it's anybody's fault, but it was a jurisdictional issue, and it got tossed back and forth between a couple of county sheriffs, and, you know, that was time lost. That's not really anybody's fault, but it happened, you know, and that really snake bites it from the beginning.
Yeah, it's just one of those things. I know that when it was first investigated, it was investigated, I believe, in Cherokee County, which is where Chase lived.
Yeah. Then it, you know, switched over to Cobb, where I think the QT, the quick trip was.
Yeah.
So it's been one misstep after the next. And again, it's not necessarily to blame anybody, but, you know, you lose time that way.
Yeah.
It's a lot of valuable time.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate. But what was it originally that drew you to the story of Chase Masner? Was it his family and friends getting in touch with you?
That's how I found out about it.
Mm-hmm.
I find out about missing people every day. You know, I think I have almost 2,000 emails sitting there that I haven't gotten to read yet. And
wow.
I do it all day, every day, into the night. And go as fast as I can. It's just been, you know, it's like drinking from a fire hydrant. You can't get to everyone. But the way I got involved in this one was actually because of Stephanie Cadena, the mother. And after I heard her plea and spoke to her, it just broke my heart to hear her. And that's why I've gotten personally involved in it.
Yeah, I've been listening to your episodes about it on your podcast, and it's one of those, it's just really hard listening to Stephanie, because it seems like every time she starts talking about it, it's just, it's heartbreaking to hear her talk about it.
You know, it really is, and it's so murky. There's not a lot of hard facts to go on, and she's not getting answers from the police, and they're not really under a duty to tell, certainly not the media, anything, but a lot of times they don't know anything. The news may look bad, so they don't want to break that to them, to the victim's family, unless they really know that's the case. And so they don't say anything.
Yeah, and like you said, there's basically nothing to go off of. There's Chase having an argument with his wife, Amanda, and then disappearing. And he had been staying at his mom's house, but he hadn't spoken to her in, what, like 12 to 16 hours? When he disappeared, and then he disappeared from his friend's house, but besides that, there's just no information out there.
Not a lot to go on. Now, the kicker is, we tracked down the friend, who I refer to as the wild card, which is the last known person to see Chase alive. He tells me that Chase's M.O., typically, whenever he'd come over, he and Amanda, the wife, would always be fighting. Now, Amanda has picked up and left town and doesn't want to do interviews, doesn't want to get involved. She's got two little girls with Chase. And that concerns me because the investigation needs her. They need her. So that's always an issue to me if you can't get the family on board with the investigation. But for all I know, maybe she's spoken to police and I don't know the full extent of it.
Yeah.
But I would be making public pleas. I would be doing anything possible to try to find my children's father, even if I wasn't getting along with him. at the time. So their big fight that day was nothing new. So I don't read a lot of into their them having an argument. But back to Brad Clements, the so-called wild card. We tracked him down, banged on his door. To his credit, he let me in. And I grilled him over an hour and a half. Subsequent to that, I got him to meet with Stephanie, our team did, Crime Online, got him to meet with Stephanie Cadena so she could ask him questions and meet him. He is convinced that Amanda came and picked Chase up that day. No, he did not see her, but he said, he told me to my face, that she was blowing up his cell phone, you know, writing and texting and calling him to try to get him to come back. They'd had a fight. She dropped him off. She was calling back to pick him up. He leaves, comes back, and sometime after that, he goes up to Chase's room. Chase isn't there. So, you know, where else would he be? So he thinks Amanda came and picked him up. Is that true? I don't know.
Yeah, I noticed that when you were interviewing Brad, because I listened to the episode you just uploaded today. I listened to that when I first woke up. It seems like there are certain things where he tries to make himself sound super innocent. Like when he mentions that Chase was interested in getting drugs. And he just tried to say that, oh yeah, he had nothing to do with drugs, he just smoked weed and...
I hear what you're saying. And maybe he is being defensive because he has really been scrutinized very carefully. And he told me that he would take a polygraph, but he hasn't done it yet.
Interesting. Yeah, I listened to the interview.
I know.
Yeah, I'm anxiously awaiting to hear the rest of the interview because at the end of this past episode, you teased that you're going to introduce Chase's mom, Stephanie, to him. And that was going to be one of the first times they had spoken to each other. So I don't know if you could... The first, wow. So can you give any teasers about what that conversation is going to include? Or?
Well, Stephanie was extremely emotional. And, you know, it's one thing to wonder what happened and then actually meet the person that can unlock that mystery for you. It's almost overwhelming, you know, like you think about the moment, what you're going to say, what you're going to do, and then the moment comes and it's pretty daunting. I mean, she was extremely emotional, very upset. I would say the most upset I've seen her. And to her, this is very fresh. She never has given up. Every day, she's about finding Chase, and she feels like she's not getting a whole lot of help.
I don't want to say it's the most interesting, but it's the knowledge that it seems like she is the only one in Chase's life that's remained out there pushing for answers.
I know, that really bothers me.
Yeah, it seems like everyone else, like...
It would be Amanda, and I also don't like the way, without Chase here to defend himself, everybody's throwing him under the bus. I don't have any evidence of any of the ugly things people are saying about him. None of it. And according to other friends of his and family, he was a very upbeat, happy-go-lucky guy. Not at all how he's been portrayed during this investigation.
Well, that's an interesting topic. I know that it's been reported in the media that he was suffering from bipolar disorder and PTSD. Do you know anything about that? Have you talked to his mom about that at all? Or?
Yes, I did. She said that that's not true.
Interesting. Because that's one of those things that's just kind of...
I think people are saying whatever suits them after his disappearance. And I don't like that.
Yeah, that's just one of those things that I've seen in a lot of...
The guy's been in Iraq while all of us are sitting back home. The guy comes back, he tries to reassimilate into civilian life, can't find a good job, finally gets something at a Quick Trip. He's got a wife and two children to support, and she's not working, leads to a lot of marital strife. Not enough money, a lot of arguments, and then bam, he's gone. So you don't really see anybody but his mother, Stephanie, out there trying to find him. And to me, that that hurts my heart. That nobody is really out there trying to find him.
It's been over 3 years since his disappearance. They're about to send it to the cold case unit. It's really sad. It's heartbreaking.
Yeah, and it should not be cold. This should not be cold.
Yeah.
I mean, they have enough leads to work on. So, there's a lot of loose ends that I'm not at liberty to reveal right now because I've got to investigate them some more.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you this. Chase Master did not just walk out of Brad Clement's house that day and go live under a bridge in L.A. That did not happen. And, I mean, one of my favorite things, if you don't know a horse, look at his track record. He had never gone a day or two his whole life without returning his mom's texts and phone calls, if even that long. Never. So why now? Why would he do that now? And I'd like to find out where exactly is Chase's cell phone. Because there are reports that somebody that he knows has his cell phone. He had that cell phone with him the day he went missing. So whoever has the phone, if someone does have it, saw Chase, has seen Chase after he disappeared. And I'd like to know that. I mean, it's hard to put together a case when you don't have a full timeline. And while I'm on that name, if someone saw him after he left Brad Clement's home, why aren't they coming forward? Why is it so clandestine? Whenever someone lies, it makes the surrounding facts that much more nefarious. What would seem innocent to me, oh, his friend has it, oh, his mom has it, oh, his wife has it, whoever, that would seem innocent to me. Unless whomever does have that cell phone is lying about it. Then you got to question motive. So I'm trying to figure out if someone still has or had his cell phone after his disappearance. I think that would be a major, major clue.
Yeah, absolutely. Because we do know that Chase had his cell phone, and I think you mentioned on your podcast, you were talking to his mother, that it was a cell phone case that had his cell phone and his wallet. Or at least it held all of his, like, his debit cards and stuff. So I know that Brad, the friend he was staying at, had his phone for at least a few hours on the day he disappeared. Did he ever, I'm not sure if he mentioned this, did he give the phone back to Chase and then Chase disappeared?
Yeah. He said he gave it back when he got home from, I guess it was Publix grocery store that day.
Gotcha. That seems weird that someone else would have his phone other than him.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems that, I mean, here we've got an Iraqi war vet, a young guy, a husband, a father, a son, never done anything wrong in his life, just what walks out the door and disappears into thin air. And leaves behind this grieving mom. And that really bothers me. It also bothers me that nobody seems to care. And if my brother went missing, I'd want people to care.
Yeah, I'm with you. The fact that he was an Iraqi war veteran that seemed to just be struggling to make ends meet, but he's gotten, seems like, very little support from anyone in his community or his family and friends is...
I will say his mom supported him. I don't mean
that's true
necessarily financially, although maybe she did, but she was always there for him. Always there for him. And even now, I mean, it really goes to prove there's nothing like a mother's love, you know? You know, I thought I knew all about love. Oh, I knew it all. And, then my fiance was murdered before our wedding. And, but I didn't know a darn thing until I had my children. And that's a whole nother thing. It's I tell you, I thought I was going to have one child, and then I found out I was having twins. And I wrestled, like, how am I going to do all the things with two children that I had planned for one? I mean, how will I be able to devote the same amount of time and energy to two? Well, this is a surprise. Your heart just expands, you know, like the Grinch. And the Grinch.
Your heart grows three expands. Sizes that day.
I mean, it's just, it's a never-ending love. It's the best relationship you ever have, I think, is that with your child. And it never ends. And there's not going to be a threat of a divorce or a separation or anything like that. That's always your child.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really been proven true with Stephanie Cadena. She I'm gonna start crying. It's gonna be your fault. When I went to her house, she had out all these albums of Chase when he was a little boy. And she looked at one and said, that was my favorite, and started crying. I mean, I had to totally steel myself the way I used to when I was prosecuting. And you would talk to a victim's family or in court, really. I would have to leave the courtroom and go in the ladies' room and hide in the install and cry and then come back in. It's just, it was so powerful. Her love was like palpable in the room, her desire to find it. And when I asked her to her face, which in a way I wish I hadn't done it, but I did it for investigative purposes. I said, Stephanie, do you think he is still alive? I wish I hadn't asked her because it made her start crying. She said, no, I don't. And it just broke my heart. I wish I hadn't done that. It didn't change anything. I mean, my thinking was I would look at it a different way if I thought he was still alive than if we were looking for a dead body. But it doesn't really change anything, and it made her cry even more. I feel awful about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's really heartbreaking. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm just so used to having been a prosecutor for so long. I look at everything in life about evidence. You know, what does this show me? What can I do with this? How can I analyze this one piece of evidence, and what will it prove? I mean, where it was found, where it came from, the condition it was in, just a million facets to even one piece of evidence. And so I just look at things analytically that way. And I got to tell you, of course, it's a whole different investigation if you're looking for a live person. So that was my thinking, but it wasn't worth it. It was not worth asking for that.
After all of this time, all of this digging, all of these conversations with her mother and Brad and everyone, what do you think happened to Chase Masner?
Well, for one thing, I don't think he's any longer with us. I think that he's dead. And I don't like it. And I don't want it to be true. And I wish it was not true. And I would like to find a piece of evidence, just anything that would suggest to me that it's not true. But that is what all of my instinct is telling me. And again, I don't like it. I would like to find out that he's living under a bridge in L.A. or that he just chucked it all and started a new life somewhere. That's what I wish would happen, but that's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. Yeah. So that leads me back to that day at Brad Clement's home, the last known place that he was seen alive. What happened? And that's where the mystery is, the jumping off point.
Well, I guess that'll probably wrap up all the questions I have for you, but are there any other thoughts about the case you want to get out there, or any other?
Yeah, there is something. You know, victims come in all shapes and sizes, all ages, all colors, from all different circumstances. Victims, as I was saying early this morning, in yet another fight with Dan Abrams on GMA, you know, all victims are not nuns and priests and virgins and altar boys, okay? And I've learned that the hard way. The hard way. Nobody's life in my mind is worth more than another's. One victim is not more important than another victim. Chase Masner is just important as Maddie McCann or Sherry Papini or any other victim that we know of. No, he's just as important, and he deserves just as much attention and just as much investigation and thought as anybody else. And I guess that would be my message about Chase Masner.
I'm really grateful to Nancy for speaking to me. At the time, I wasn't too well versed on some of the issues regarding the case, but she really helped clarify them for me and explained her thoughts on the matter. So if you're listening, Nancy, thank you. I know many have disagreements on how she broaches certain stories, but she was nothing but nice to me. There were a few things, however, that I disagree with her about. Namely, of course, the issue of drugs and mental illnesses, which I've briefly touched on in this episode. It seems to me that the topic of drugs hasn't really been brought up at all in relation to Chase's disappearance. He was arrested for the possession of marijuana as a baby-faced 18-year-old, and according to the conversation we listened to between Amanda and another woman, Chase may have had issues with heroin in the past. Then, of course, we have Brad saying that Chase was looking for Roxy's, aka Roxycodone, which is an opiate pain reliever. While this may just be a byproduct of Brad deflecting, it's a worthy lead to consider that I haven't seen a lot of people really talk about. During the research for this episode, I happened to stumble upon a few articles talking about heroin use in Georgia, most printed at around the same time period that Chase disappeared. Now, I'm not saying that I believe Chase did heroin. For all I know, he never touched the stuff. So I just want to preempt the discussion by saying that. However, considering that we've heard audio of his wife discussing the fact that he may have had a problem with narcotics in the past, and that the last known person Chase spoke to said he was looking for opiates, I think it's at least worthy of a discussion. With that being said, I think it's relevant to note that between 2013 and 2014, the amount of people killed due to drug overdoses increased by over 10%. That's not nothing. In 2010, the state faced just 3 deaths caused by heroin overdoses. In 2013, that number had risen to 32. Then, in 2014, that number had nearly doubled from the year prior to 59 deaths caused by heroin in the state of Georgia. The following is from a WSB-TV Atlanta news clip.
A suburban mom whose son died from a heroin overdose just weeks ago tells Channel 2 Action News that she hopes police will arrest the man who sold him the deadly drugs. Channel 2's Tom Regan is live in Vinings in Cobb County with details on the evidence the grieving family hopes will now bring justice. Tom?
Well, Craig, the mother told me that her son bought heroin from a dealer that he met inside a restaurant here in the Cumberland Mall area of Vining. She says there's actual security camera video of this transaction, which is now part of the police investigation.
As a mother, you know in your heart, if he hadn't come home, he's not coming home.
Missy Owen last saw her son Davis the evening of March 3rd. The 20-year-old college student completed rehab just weeks earlier, but relapsed, meeting a dealer inside a Cobb restaurant.
They have him on video where he passed something to Davis, and then he went out to the parking lot and shot the heroin and died.
She told me the dealer later discovered her deceased son in the car and called 911.
And waited for the ambulance and the police to show up. And when they did, he walked away scot-free.
Inside Davis's car, they found the remains of the heroin that killed him. Missy told me her son was an outstanding high school student, a class president with a 3.8 average, pursuing a business major. Until he entered rehab, she had no idea he was using heroin.
What the heroin dealers are doing is sending people out to the suburbs.
She said Davis first became addicted to pain pills that he'd snatched from the parents' medicine cabinet. Days before his overdose death, he warned his older sister, a Georgia Tech student, to stay away from drugs.
He knew he was an addict, but he was doing everything in his power to be released from this.
Davis just had this magnetism about him that if you knew him, you loved him.
Missy also told me that it's vital for the entire family to be involved in the rehab process. She is also establishing a foundation in tribute to her son to raise awareness and support for heroin addicts and their families. In Cobb County, Vinings, Tom Regan, Channel 2 Action News.
That was a heartbreaking story, which I find very similar to that of Chase Masner's. Davis Owen was a promising young man with the entire world in front of him. It's also noteworthy that this story was presented by WSB-TV less than a week before Chase Masner's disappearance, and came at around the time that a batch of tainted heroin had hit the area of Atlanta. Davis Owen attended school at Kennesaw State University, not even 5 minutes away from the Quick Trip that Chase worked at. just 3 or so miles away from where Brad Clement lived. Here's a phone conversation between Brad Clement and Amanda Masner on April 16th of 2014, just a few weeks after Chase had disappeared. It's also worth noting that this conversation took place at 2 o'clock in the morning, which explains why Amanda sounds so tired.
Hey, Amanda.
Yeah?
You sleeping?
Mm-hmm.
Hey, I'm sorry to call you so late. I was just thinking, I was kind of walking through the neighborhood, and I just remembered, do you know the guy that lived down the street from me that Chase used to get that stuff from? Because I remembered he lived in my neighborhood, and I couldn't remember. Have you tried to call that guy, or do you know who he is? Do you know who I'm talking about?
No, I don't.
He said that he lived right in my neighborhood, and I think that is a big step to this. We could just figure out who that guy is.
But if you're talking about the guy that he like he got weed for that one day.
Yeah, that's the guy I'm talking about.
That's like some 45-year-old. His name's Bo.
Bo
or something.
And do you know him well? Like, do you think that he could have gone there that day?
No, Chase doesn't really know him that well either. He just met him a few weeks ago. He's like some old business guy, like kind of a nerd. And Chase just hooked him up and got him weed a few times.
Okay. Well, I was just wondering.
But
his
number should be in Chase's phone.
Okay, well, tomorrow
I'll try to get that number.
Okay, cool. I'm just, still doing what I can, Amanda, and trying to find him and get some closure. And, just all of us are finally getting, accused of just all kinds of stuff, I feel like. So I just want to, get it done, And
yeah, definitely.
Definitely just... Well, sleep tight, and I hope everything's doing all right with you, all right? And if you, like I said, need anything, don't hesitate to call me if you, if you need anything that's not going to get you in trouble from talking to me. But I just thought that that guy, really could have some importance to this, because I don't think we've gone that route at all. So
yeah, I'll look up his number.
Okay, well, sleep tight. I'll talk to you soon, all right?
Okay, thank you.
Take care. Bye.
To me, it sounds like Brad is implying that Chase might have searched out a local drug dealer, or someone that he had associated with drugs in the past. It seems like in the beginning of the conversation, Brad is hinting at something other than weed, which Amanda casually states. Maybe that's just me reading too much into it after listening to that recording dozens of times, but I find this conversation very intriguing. Like I said just a few minutes ago, I don't want to believe that Chase Masner was the victim of a heroin overdose. But unfortunately, the alternatives don't sound much more plausible. I don't believe that someone would have tried to abduct or just randomly kill Chase, who was an army veteran who is still in great shape. And I also don't believe that he would have willingly ran away and left his family behind. The only other plausible alternative, I feel, is that Chase was suffering from severe mental health issues. He had been suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder after his tour in Iraq, which we know after hearing his wife Amanda say so in an audio clip. I've also seen comments online that Chase may have been suffering from the beginning stages of bipolar disorder, but that seems more like internet speculation than anything. He would be at the right age for a mental instability to start manifesting itself, but we have no definitive proof that that's what was happening. Brad Clement said in an offhand remark that Chase had talked about running off and living in the woods. Who knows, maybe he did. Maybe he's been living in the Georgia woods for years, just surviving and scavenging. That's what I'd like to think happened to Chase Masner. In the years since Chase Masner disappeared, many of the lives he touched have struggled to move on. Brad Clement, the friend who was the last known person to see Chase alive, has definitely struggled. He gave up his big house in Kennesaw, Georgia, and has struggled to remain employed. He states that the scrutiny brought upon him following the disappearance of his friend has just been too much. He hopes that his recent interview with Nancy Grace will help clear his name, although he continues to lie low. Amanda Masner, Chase's wife, moved out of Georgia with the couple's two kids roughly a year after Chase went missing. She also faced her fair amount of scrutiny, and decided that it wasn't a good environment for their two children to grow up in. She moved to the Burlington region of Iowa, which, not coincidentally, is where Chase's father Corbin lives. Corbin Masner, who had been living with the couple in the months before Chase's disappearance, is an enigma to me. I can see that he has a bit of a checkered past when it comes to the law, which I won't go into detail about here, but he was let go from his job in 2013 because of it. That's why he was living with his son's family during this time period. It seems like Amanda chose to remain close to Corbin, her children's grandfather, and followed him back to Iowa. Stephanie Cadena, Chase's mother, still lives in Georgia, and has remained the most vocal proponent of finding Chase over the past few years.
I've lived the last 3 years not knowing. And every single day, it's just hell.
Answers about Chase Masner have been very few and far in between. He received a strong show of support from the online community in the first year or so after his disappearance, but bickering and infighting between multiple groups led to much of the conversation getting blocked or deleted. I've been trying to speak to the largest Facebook community in search of people that know Chase, but I've really gotten nowhere with that. A short while after Chase went missing, a mysterious comment by his father Corbin online inspired a bit of controversy. He told members of the online community to stop posting about Chase, and implied that he'd never be found. I'm paraphrasing, of course, because the comment has since been deleted. But this comment, while very odd and off-putting, has resulted in no real information coming to light. I just find it odd that a father would put something like that out on the internet. Several groups, including some veterans groups and Missing in America, have conducted searches in the area around Cobb and Cherokee County to try and find anything. Unfortunately, after 3 years, they have yet to find anything concrete. Chase Masner stood 6'2" and weighed about 175 pounds at the time of his disappearance. He was a physically attractive young man with dark hair and a winning smile. He had multiple tattoos, including two roses on his chest, the last name Masner scrawled along the top of his back, the phrase "Never Depart 02072010 on his right forearm, and other miscellaneous tattoos. He was last seen wearing a red Quick Trip sweatshirt and khaki pants. If any of these sound familiar, or you think you may know anything about Chase Masner and his disappearance, please get in touch with the Cobb County Police Department at 770-499-3945. The reward for information is now $5,000, and this case has been forwarded to the Cold Case Unit. The story of Chase Masner is still unresolved. If you're interested in following along with the podcast on social media and staying privy to all of the changes coming ahead, you could find us at twitter.com/unresolvedpod, facebook.com/theunresolvedpodcast, or you could even follow along at the podcast blog, theunresolvedpodcast.com. There you could find links to the aforementioned sites, transcripts for each episode, articles and sources I utilize for research, and any other pertinent information that you may need. If you'd like to stay in touch in other ways, you can reach me at theunresolvedpodcast@gmail.com or unresolvedpod@gmail.com or even at 831-200-3550, which is available for your voicemails and text. If you would like to help the podcast continue to evolve, you can do so at patreon.com/unresolvedpod. There, you could become a patron and get access to a bevy of perks, such as the rough cut of each episode as soon as it's recorded, unedited interviews, audio clips, and other extras we cook up, and you could even vote for an upcoming episode. Also, soon it will be the only place to get episodes without any advertisements. It's because of these Patreon supporters that I was recently able to upgrade some recording equipment, which is why this episode may sound noticeably improved from the last. The next goal we're aiming for is to have regular episodes out every 2 weeks. You can help us reach that goal by supporting the podcast on Patreon. Trust me, I know that the long absences suck. You don't have to send me another message or comment telling me so. I know. However, speaking of the Patreon, I'd like to thank the following people for becoming patrons since the last episode. Nathan, Tobias, Clem, Vivian, and Lauren. The five of you have joined the ranks of my favorite people, so thank you. And speaking of my favorite people, as always, I'd like to throw a debt of gratitude towards Tyson Nordgren, who just continues to weave his musical magic on each episode. I know I say this all the time, but I really owe him so much for holding my hand throughout the recording and editing process. And the work that he does for the podcast is tremendous. Thanks, Tyson. Lastly, of course, I have to say thank you to Nancy Grace, who was kind enough to speak to me about the case of Chase Masner. I can only hope to speak to her again in the future, and hopefully with some semblance of a happy ending. That came out wrong. I'm sorry. Thank you, Nancy. And before I leave, I'd like to recommend that all of you check your podcast app and search for any other feeds of the podcast. I'm going to be switching RSS feeds soon, so whether you listen to iTunes, Stitcher, or some other app, just check and make sure that if there are two unresolved podcast feeds that you're subscribed to both of them. One is going to stop updating in the near future, and I just want to make sure that you don't miss out on any of the upcoming episodes. Also, I know that I say this all the time, but I really hope to not have any more long gaps between episodes. Things have finally begun to normalize in my world, and the more supporters that the podcast gets means the more time I could dedicate to it. So just continue to spread the word, whether it be through a share on social media, a review on iTunes or Stitcher, or a pledge on Patreon. Every little bit helps. Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, stay safe.